Mr. Cochrane, Rail 20. We were talking about your new colonel, Colonel MGO Hill, Monks Hill. He was a Cameron Harland, you were saying?
He had been seconded to another regiment and had been serving in Burma. He was no stranger to action. And I resented this at first, because I thought Gordon Munro commanded us well, and reorganized us well. And I always thought the bloody army, you wouldn't accept territorial chaff as a commanding officer, and you had to go to the ends of the earth, Burma, to find a senior major, and so on and so forth. And so I began by sort of grudging his appearance. But in fact, I was totally wrong, because he was an absolutely wonderful commanding officer.
In what way? What was so good about him?
First of all, he was quite unflappable. Nothing fazed him. He knew exactly what he wanted to do. He knew, obviously, he had spotted what he thought were things that this battalion needed to have done for it to make it really effective. He made changes, for instance, to my two company commanders. Well, really, because of age, they were compared to a lot of us, they were old men, 40 maybe. And he was convinced that you had to have younger men commanding companies. If you had young officers capable of doing so. He was very good with, he was absolutely red hot on communication. I don't mean in that in the sort of army signaling sense. He felt that it was absolutely essential that the soldiers should know precisely what was going on, what was going on elsewhere around them, what they were meant to be doing in their, wherever they were now, and what, if you weren't in the line, what you were preparing for as your next next job. And he insisted on his officers, if he thought they weren't good communicators with their men, he insisted that they must be. And he himself was, when we were out of the line, he would amble around the different companies, looking, listening, talking, and then going back and thinking over what he thought about this or that company, where it was strong, where it was weak, where it needed help, when it needed kicking up the bottom. And and he was very sort of unbombastic, no shouting and jumping around, and spoke on the whole quietly. But my goodness, when he was giving orders, you knew they were orders. He was a wonderful CO. I was very lucky, because in the desert and at Kerin, we had Andy Anderson, who was an old regular soldier commissioned in the field in World War I, and he proved the untruth of Mobbs Hill's dictum about age, because he was, I suppose, comparatively old, having enlisted as a jock in 1913. He was comparatively old to be commanding a battalion, but he was superb. And then Mobbs Hill equally was, in a quite different style, quite different way, but he was good. And under him, it did become a very good battalion.
now from one end of the scale to the other. What about your servant? Because he's someone who crops up quite a bit.
Bill Finn. Still a good friend. He had. I don't quite know how he became my batman, or perhaps when I got to C Company in the Shetlands, who was already the previous company commander's batman. But he was a slim, fair-haired chap. He tended rather, when he was about to make a joke, he would blush slightly. He was a very good footballer, and also he had, in City Street, I think he had enlisted, I think, just before the war. But he'd been a bomber, so he was a great asset to the company. When he wasn't looking after me, he kept everybody's head cut, hair cut. And he was not only a jolly good batman from the point of view of looking after my kid, but an officer shouldn't have, if he has time to look after his own kit, he's not doing his proper job as an officer. So it matters a great deal if you have an efficient batman who packs things up every time you move neatly, knows where things are. And then, of course, the batman has to act also as a runner. And when you're in action, the wireless communications were pretty ropey at that time. I mean, they existed, but the big wireless set, there was a chap had to carry it like a very heavy pack on his back, it was liable to, well, you. The receiving end, the platoon end, it was difficult to hear very often. And certainly when, you know, in the middle of a bombardment, it was pretty useless. So in fact, a company runner, and then a platoon runner, to get verbal messages was essential. Which meant, of course, that the runner had to be capable of doing things on his own, finding his way here and there, and also to deliver a short, coherent, succinct message when he got to the other end, and then get back again. Not an easy job, and Finn was excellent. Also, Finn drove, as a company commander, I had a Jeep, and he drove that all over Italy. And as I say, in addition to all that, he was an extraordinarily nice person. I was very fond of him, and still am. The next thing I think I can remember was we were sent from this Adriatic back into the middle of Italy. At least I get it mixed up here.
There's a period at Ariely I wanted to ask you about. Well, that was from mid-April to early May. Do you recall that? I think that's still on the.
We went at one point. We were supposed to go we did go on what was a mountain warfare training course at Camp Abasso, right in the middle of Italy.
That's after Ariely, yeah. Ariely, sorry.
Yeah.
You don't recall Ariely too well.
Yes, well. But I think that happened after our mountain training thing.
It's not in the book, but it could.
It must have been. I got mixed up then. But Ariely was good for the company. That was the division was holding a line quite far forward. In fact, we were sort of salient, pushing forward. And one of the positions that had to be held, again, this was to be held in readiness for an attack from it or through it. One didn't do any attacking from Ariely. It was a small town built on a sort of headland of rock that stuck out into a big valley. And the Germans were on the other side of the valley. The valley was kind of no man's land. And there was a company in this ruined town, which had been smashed flat pretty well. Yeah, it was biggish. Well, it had two or three schools and three churches, or the remains of three churches. It was big enough for me to be given another platoon from B Company. So I had four platoons up there. And this was, again, nightlife, because at night we had to, well, we did a lot of patrolling. And we found when we arrived there, the Germans used to patrol into the town at night. Well, we stopped that by shooting up a few of their patrols, and we in our turn patrolled forward across the valley towards their position.
What was the typical, would you go on a patrol as a company commander, or would you order them out?
I would send out, there always went for an officer, of course, but I used to wait behind near the telephone back to battalion headquarters wait for the patrols to come back.
How were the patrols organised then?
The patrol probably would be something like two and a half hours. And one had to be, we had an FOO, a gunner officer with us, always up there, and he had his line, or WT, back to his regiment of guns. And we had various laid down, pre-arranged chutes. But we had to be very meticulous, both for the platoons guarding the perimeter, the houses on the edge of the town, above the cliff, or the steepest slope down to the valley, and the gunners, as to what the times of patrols were and the routes. And I was always very uneasy when the patrols were out.
What type of patrol were they? I mean, were they the reconnaissance, or standing, or fighting?
No, we did have a standing patrol that went out every night to a ruined farmhouse, which was halfway across the valley. I hated this. I mean, this had been, the battalion before us had done the same thing, and it was part of the drill, if you like, that a standing patrol every night went out and occupied this building. And I thought doing the same thing night after night for a month was asking for trouble, since our predecessors had been doing it. Also, I seemed to have no point in it. So I cancelled this, and we laid mines in and around it for our last visit there, and then arranged. We waited, I think, 24 hours, and the following, or perhaps 48 hours, and then we heard odd pops of the mines, some mines going off. So we reckoned that probably by now the Germans had put a standing patrol in, so we called down for a big stomp from their guns, which demolished it. But the other patrols, sometimes reconnaissance patrols, you know, no fighting, and go and listen, hear what's going on, and what signs were coming from the enemy side. Sometimes a fighting patrol, the object being deliberately to try and catch a German patrol and get a prisoner or two. I hated sending these patrols out. They were very important. But you never knew whereabouts, again in the darkness, the Germans had laid new mines, you know, as opposed to the ones that you noticed before. You never knew whether it was going to be the equivalent of an ambush. Cat and mouse it was. And I find it very disagreeable to be sending people out to do this and not going with them myself. But in fact, my job was to be at the HQ. We were shelled heavily in the daytime.
Was that shell fire or mortar fire?
That was, I think, shell fire. Because, in fact, it was shell fire rather than mortar fire. Going back to the patrols, one of the patrols, I heard a lot of shooting. They came back with 10 prisoners. And we had one chap slightly wounded. And so I sent back to Battalion HQ to send up an escort for them. We were very tickled with ourselves. And then very disappointed to learn that, in fact, really, they weren't. They were in army German uniform, of course, but they were actually Ukrainians. They'd been conscripted and compelled to fight. And the Germans had been so injudicious as to let a patrol of them go out. And they were looking for people to be to surrender to. The shelling did cause some casualties during the daytime, but not many, because mostly in the daytime were in the buildings and low down, I mean in the ground floor. And once I remember the shelling set fire to two or three buildings on the edge of the town, and these were important for us because needed them as our sort of outwork, if you like, defensive position. And so we had to put the fire out. There was plenty of water in the area because there were wells in the not yet blocked up. But very oddly, it must have been in full view, I think, of the enemy as we doused the flames. We had perhaps a platoon and a half of chaps carrying the water and chucking the buckets over. But oddly enough, there was no shooting at all. We got on with it undisturbed and got the flames out and the soldiers back in position. So that was actually rather good for the company because they knew they were doing a good job. They were on their own, which is always a popular thing on detachment. The casualties weren't excessive, they could, in a way, see what they were doing and see why they were doing it, which hadn't been true at Casino. So we came away from Harriere, we were eventually relieved by an Indian Punjabi regiment in the brigade. So we came back from Marielle as really a properly functioning company, I think.
There then seems to have been a period of advance through past Pescara, and then you went to the mountain warfare.
Yes.
Do you know, this was the advance, I think, to the Gothic line.
And yes.
At one point, you were the right-hand company.
Yes, we were there.
Next to the sea. What about that advance to the Gothic line? Is there anything you remember? I think we'll nice to know about the crossing of the Pescara, but anything else before we get to that?
No, the advance was up the coast was, it was very nice to be on the coast because there was a sort of headland stuck into the sea, and the Germans, I'm certain, were all bathing the lovely beaches the other side of the headland, and certainly our chaps were all bathing furiously, enjoying the sea and the sun on our side. A ludicrous order came from Army headquarters, or some corps headquarters, to say that soldiers must not bathe naked, it would defend the local susceptibility, and that caused a hoarse laugh, as you can imagine, from everybody. Pescara was the next town as such, and that had been evacuated. Not damaged too badly, except the road bridge had been blown up and lying in the water. It took some time getting over that. We did have a platoon, or two platoons, went round Pescara by sea in those curious vehicles called ducks, which then made their appearance for us for the first time. They were run, they were American in origin, of course. Ran on wheels or with a propeller. They were actually manned, in our case, by Royal Engineers. So we picked our way through the town and over the one girder that remained of the bridge. The others went round by sea, round Pescara, round the mouth of the little river there. The main road up the coast had been heavily mined.
Now, I wanted to ask you about mines, because we haven't talked about them, but there were some new types of mines as well, like the shoe mine and various other things.
Well, yes, their mines were, of course, by this time of the war, the mines were much more effective than the ones the Italians had used. Various types of them. The ones which are really rather frightening, the ones called shoe mines, they were wooden ones, so therefore they didn't show up on the then metal detectors that one had. The only way you could find those was the old-fashioned way of the unfortunate pioneer platoon, who were also the mine clearers, had to lie on their bellies and probe with a thin wire. Because if you trod on a shoe mine, it wouldn't kill you, probably, but it certainly would take your foot off. I suppose that's why they were so called. The other mines, vehicle mines, were much more devastating. I mean, they were designed to blow the track off a small tank, certainly blow up a lorry. They were delicately set, so I mean, marching men would set them off. And the Germans wanted time. The Gothic line, their next big line of defense right across Italy, or at least from the Adriatic to the mountains and the spine of Italy, and then from the spine of Italy down to the other shore, they weren't fully prepared. They were still creating a deep defensive area. So they were doing a delaying action. On the whole, except in most places, when you took a German position, they didn't counterattack. They merely withdrew to the next prepared interim position. The idea was to hold up the Allied advance until the Gothic line was fully ready. Hence, of course, the importance of mines, because if you can slow up the vehicles, an army can't get all that far. At least you can get a battalion on its feet going here and there, but they can't continue for very long without access to vehicles for their kit, ammunition, grub, and so forth.
What about booby traps? As opposed
well,
to mines.
We knew these existed, and we were warned about them. I think the warning, in a polite way, was never phrased, but it was a warning to certainly everybody, officers and men, when you see what looks like an intact, abandoned farmhouse or place in a bombed town, don't go rushing in looking for loot. They didn't spell this out, but be very careful how you go in. A half-open door, a loo chain, electric light switch, something that looks interesting lying on a table, these could all have been entrapped. In fact, in some cases, they were. I mean, there were in the division enough, even if perhaps not very many, but there were enough booby trap casualties to make everybody pretty windy about them. I only came across, well, not one, but I thought it might be one, in a place where obviously it had been the HQ of the German battalion or company, and a book had been left lying on a table in the remains of a building, and obviously inviting someone to pick it up. And I got hold of a very long pole and I poked it, but nothing happened. And then found it was a book in English, Conrad's Nostromo, I think I've got which title it was, in an English guy, with a German inscription in it to whoever was going to come along from the his enemy side. Very sterling thing about you'll never win the war and you're this, that, and the other. You'll never see your something England again, where your women are having a fine time with the Yanks, something like this. And as I said in that book, there's bad luck on this chap. He signed himself a German soldier. All this was written in English, good English. Bad luck on him that he happened to pick on the one chap in the division with a Yank wife, the reverse of what he'd been saying. It was a slow business because they each place they evacuated, or whether they'd done it at their leisure or whether they'd been pushed out, was obviously had been carefully registered, so that when they were out and they reckoned you were in, they could bring down shell fire or mortar fire on it. So it wasn't it wasn't plain sailing, and in some places where they felt that they did counterattack, they obviously felt that they still had to fight for more time, and those were difficult because we had casualties in those counterattacks. And then, of course, we had to attack again. And I think we had more casualties, really, probably, from the, not the actual fighting, when you got up to the enemy lines and drove them out, than we did from the shelling beforehand and afterwards. We had number of casualties, officer casualties as well as men, and sometimes this was, you could guess the obvious place to bring counterfire down actually was on the ground, and you took good care not to have any soldiers in that area. Sometimes you found that there's no way you could avoid it. You had to be where the counterfire would come down.
Now, how long were you doing this advance along the coast? Had it started in June, or you were at Ariely from April to May?
Yes. We had we had about 3 weeks of this after the Pescara, the seaside thing. Our role was then going to be going up the middle of Italy, and we were sent off for 3 weeks, I think it was, mountain warfare training course.
So what do you remember of that? That was at Campo Basso.
Yes, yes. Well, it was the first time, actually, since, I suppose, I don't know when, that the whole battalion was together. I mean, we were grouped, obviously, by companies. We did have tents there, a tented camp. But it was the first time for ages, certainly since, well, Toronto, I suppose, that you actually could see people in the other companies and do a bit of socializing.